Hi there, welcome to the Abbey Lane Beatles podcast. I'm your host, Michael M. You know, earlier this year I interviewed John Derringer, and it was a really fun interview. Now don't get me wrong, all my interviews have been great, and I've really enjoyed them. What I liked about the John Derringer interview was that it was two Beatle fans having a fireside chat, if you will. Talking to each other, expressing our views, and how we feel about the Beatles. And I wanted to do more of that. Now don't get me wrong, I still love talking to authors and people who have done other interesting things about the Beatles, but I really like the fireside chat concept, and I wanted to do more of that. And so that's what we have today. So please join me as what I hope is the first of many fireside chat with the Beatle fan. My guest today is Paul Myers. Paul's a Canadian author, journalist, musician, and songwriter. Now, Paul was a member of the band The Gravelberries, who had a hit in the early 90s with a song called Wonder Where You Are Tonight. The band disbanded in 1995, but he continues to write and record music. He's also appeared on several TV programs, including as a judge for the show Pop Stars The One, and he had a popular radio program in 2003 in Vancouver, Canada, which had a very popular following. Now, Paul's also a journalist, and he's been so since the early 90s, and he's written for many musical publications. And he's written several books, including ones about the Bare Naked Ladies, Long John Baldry, Todd Rundgren, and his most recent one about Kids in the Hall, called Kids in the Hall, One Dumb Guy, which is my personal favorite. Now I'm going to be sure to include links to all of these books so you can pick them up on your own. Paul also has a podcast called The Record Store Day Podcast with Paul Myers. He's hosted some amazing guests, and it's a lot of fun to listen to. If you're a music fan, and I know most of you are, I highly recommend it. One of his most recent episodes was all about Get Back, where he had Giles Martin, Mike McGeer McCartney, and photographer Ethan Russell. That was a great episode, and that one's definitely one I recommend for all my Beatle listeners. And of course, Paul is a Beatles fan, and that's why we're here today. So I hope you enjoy the interview. So please welcome my guests, Paul Myers. Hey, Paul, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, man?
I'm really good. I'm super, super excited to have you on the show today.
Well, I appreciate that.
You know, I mentioned in your opening that you're a man of many talents, you know, what we'll call you sort of a Renaissance man, if you will.
Small R, maybe. Yeah.
And I'm just happy to have you here talking about Beatles. You know, I mentioned in the opening about your books. You've written a few books. And quickly before we get started on the whole Beatles thing, I wanted to give you your props for my favorite of your books is the one about the kids in the hall, One Dumb Guy. It is absolutely fantastic.
You
did
a
great job. And I think like some most general fans would just think that these guys just came out of nowhere. But you lay that whole story down. And how it segues into this is I sort of compare the kids in the hall to the Beatles in the sense that, you know, they did those 10,000 hours to become professionals. I just thought they came out of nowhere. And they didn't. They really paid their dues, I'll tell you. So, great book. I really enjoyed it.
I really appreciate you saying that. Like, a lot of my books are labors of love. A lot of my books are me answering the question, how come there isn't a book like this yet? And that one was definitely, I've always, as you might know, and some of your listeners might not, I kind of grew up around them as they were starting out. We were all friends on the Toronto scene. And I dabbled in improv comedy, not so good, but I knew Kevin and Dave and getting to know Mark and Bruce and Scott. And all the way along, me and a lot of my friends were in the same social scene as them. And then they went off and did their thing. So for years, as I got sort of more adept at writing biographies, I thought, how come I haven't written the story of like these guys who are my friends? But also, I think the argument is that they are as influential on comedy as, well, I mean, I don't want to get into that thing, but I mean, SCTV, SNL, Monty Python, the kids in the hall have a place at that table. And that's what I wanted to say in the book. So I appreciate that it found you.
And it's a fair statement that, you know, I would put them on the plateau with the SCTVs and the Monty Python for sure. And I don't think, I'll put it out there. I don't think in memory that I can think of any other comedy troupe that I would put up quite as that high level as Monty Python as Kids in the Hall. Absolutely.
So, yeah, I mean, they would be blown away by that. And I was recently involved in something where Eddie Izzard had said the same thing, the comedian Eddie Izzard, that in Eddie's opinion, Monty Python, the true lineage was the Kids in the Hall, which I know it blew Kevin away when he heard that, like that, you know.
Absolutely.
A British person saying that is kind of amazing too, you know. Anyway, yeah, well, that's great.
Right, so enough about that. I'm sure maybe some of my fans are a Kids in the Halls fan, but I know they're here about Beatles, so let's talk Beatles. How long have you been a Beatles fan?
I would like to say since birth. Giving away my age, might as well get it over with. I'm 61 years old right now, just turned. So I was basically, you know, 3 years old when the Beatles hit North America. And my parents, many people who know me and my family know this, but my parents are both from Liverpool and they moved to Toronto in the 50s and they had started having children. So when the Beatles were starting to make it, my parents were really excited that, you know, four lads from over home were on the TV and there. And even if they weren't predisposed to rock and roll, they bought into the whole charm. They recognized the Liverpool wit in the Beatles and they recognized the, you know, a bunch of four scallies, you know, they recognized it and they knew. And then it turns out they wrote really melodic songs as well that my parents, they love a good tune, as they would say. And they you know, my mom obviously veered towards McCartney. My dad recognized Lennon's sarcasm and we all loved Ringo and George, you know, and it was just, the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan show. I'm told I was watching it. I was probably a really small baby, but that kind of thing really affects you when you know what Beatlemania is at four. And you kind of know that you, all the older girls and, you know, the girls who were older than me, who were probably 10 and 12 and 14, they seem like grown-up girls and they were really into, and maybe there's something to be said for sexual orientation. I was absolutely excited that the girls liked the Beatles and I knew right away that I wanted the girls to be, you know, interested in something that I was interested in. So I was, you know, Beatle fan and I would just love the Beatles all the way through those years. And the funny thing, and again, I told you, I warned you ahead of time off the air that I would give you long answers. The only thing I will tell you is I have strayed from the Beatles. I haven't really meaningfully in the last 30 years, but there've been times when I was about seven, maybe six. I was six. The Monkees were on TV and the Monkees were so good and they were so much fun and they were on TV every week. And the Beatles had started to become kind of grown-ups around Pepper. And I wasn't sure if I still liked the Beatles. I thought I liked them, but I loved the Monkees because they were in my face. And I still, you know, to my day, I will go and confess before the Beatle church that I strayed. I was, and I told Mickey Dolenz and Mike Nesmith this on stage last year in San Francisco, 2 years ago in San Francisco. I said, you know, you guys were the only thing that pulled me away from the Beatles for a short period. I said, but I'm sorry to say to them that I, you know, I quickly realized. But anyway, so that was the other one was like when I started getting into Led Zeppelin and you know, and then new wave and punk, I probably put my Beatles to the side and then quickly brought them back. So that's my Beatle lineage. I hope I told you something in that answer.
No, that's great. Now, do you remember, I mean, obviously you were really young, you were told you saw them in Ed Sullivan, but do you remember when you first heard them and recognized the music and loved it?
Yes. It was A Hard Day's Night. And when they sing She Loves You, to me, that song is Beatlemania. So, you know, there's something about, obviously in the movie when the girls are screaming, but there's something about the She Loves You and Please Please Me. Those songs, they just had, and I still haven't found anything that does it, that same thing. I've had songs I liked. I've had rock and roll that's moved me. I've had heavier things that have moved me. But there's something about the dialed in balance between innocence and lust and all those things that shouldn't exist together. It's melodic. It's rocking. It's polished, it's rough, it's all these contradictions. And there's something that you could only call Beatlemania in that. Like, and that's, you know, so from that point on, that is in your heart. And that, you know, not to get too poetic, but I'll be poetic enough that to say that is in your heart forever. And that is, that's, it's something that is nurtured from time to time, or maybe subdued from time to time. So that's, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So was it the Beatles that made you want to become a musician, or was it another band?
You know, I think deep down it was the Beatles. I used to write on the back of my, okay, so here's the other thing. So my birthday is November 11th, and that's just before Christmas. So once I realized I liked the Beatles, when I started getting old enough, I think around the time of, I can't remember what year it was, but I started getting all the back Beatle albums for Christmas and my birthday and Christmas. And so I used to write on them, like on the back of Revolver, I added, and Paul Myers as a member of the Beatles. Like, so, you know, and I was excited that Paul McCartney's initials were Paul M, or that his name was Paul M. And I was like, I could be. And then I would like I'd sort of fantasize about what it would be like to be in the studio when they, like in that photograph on the back of Revolver, they're in the studio. And
yeah.
Like, what would it be like to be in a recording studio? That seemed like a church. Like, and I wasn't religious, so for me, it was the church. I mean, so to be one of those guys who got to make records and play guitars and stand on stage strumming, anytime I saw a kid in my neighborhood with an electric guitar, they were touching the Beatles as far as I was concerned. There was one removed from the Beatles. So every local high school band that I knew, oh my God, you guys, you know, like, can I touch your electric guitar? And I would hold it. And of course, I didn't know how to play yet, but I could stand like John Lennon. I could stand like George Harrison. I probably wasn't standing like Paul McCartney because I knew even then that he was the bass player. So, but,
right.
You know, and we all air drummed like Ringo with our heads bopping. You know, we did the Ringo head bop. I mean, so I would say that that's when I don't know if it was when I seriously wanted to be a musician, but that's when it looked like an interesting thing to do.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you. And that one point you touched on there about just, even if you couldn't play it, just holding it and standing it there, the visual can do an incredible amount.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned in some of your tweets that, you know, you are a fan of vocal arrangements.
Oh yes.
And you have not been afraid to point out specifics on Twitter. So is that what you love most about the Beatles?
I don't know. I will tell you in all earnestness, I think the vocal harmonies and arrangements are certainly in the top 3 to 5 things. But the real thing is depth of melodic invention. And by that, I mean the ability to take a melody and go into, and it's largely McCartney, but Lennon does it too. And Harrison does it too. And let's say Ringo does it too. I mean, Octopus's Garden, you know, it's a great song, but generally what I love is the way, and also when they were Lennon and McCartney, when it would be a melody by John, then Paul would come up with a new part that had a melody that was not like the other part, and yet you couldn't imagine the two parts together, the classic being A Day in the Life. And, you know, the woke up, fell out of bed part fits perfectly into John's main song. And to me, the fact that they had so many melodies and so many places to take a song, and then they had so many styles of songs. So I guess those were the things that made me realize they're really special, because, you know, the Beatles were like microclimates. If it was raining, if it literally the rain in one song, it would be Good Day Sunshine in another song, you know, like,
and, right.
And none of those songs should sound the same. And the glue is the harmonies, you know, and this is like one of my favorite Canadian bands, Sloan, have 4 guys writing different songs. And yet when you hear the harmonies, you know, it's Sloan. Well, I mean, they'll be happy to hear me compare them to the Beatles. They've probably heard it before, but that's the same thing. The sonic glue being the unique blend of John, Paul, and George. And more so after seeing Get Back, do I realize just how much George is part of that vocal blend. I think I've always known, but you see it on mic. You know, you see that it's not just John singing with Paul. There's George in there all the time, you know?
It's funny you say that about Sloan. When you said that, it made me think of their album Navy Blues.
Yes.
Is right on par with Beatles. And I have said that for years. And it's funny that you just made that comparison, because now it qualifies what I had said and what I had thought about that Navy Blues.
Well, I think about them a lot because I know them, and I did an interview with them for the Parallel Play album. And the term parallel play refers to the idea of children playing alongside each other and, you know, and sharing something. And, you know, Sloan in that concept were a 4-way highway a four-lane highway. They were all going the same direction roughly, but there were four distinct lanes. And I watched Get Back, all the whole show, and realized what we were watching was creative play, which often turns to creative arguments. And yep. But overall, when they start going into funny voices, we're talking about the Beatles again, when yep. they go into funny voices, or when they do shtick, or when they do an old rock and roll jam, they're trying each other on in a creative parallel play way. They're trying to sort of reconnect in the playground. And we've never seen it before. We've maybe seen promotional films before, but we've never seen the cameras. It's almost Jane Goodall levels anthropology to see, you know, you want to hear like Richard Attenborough come in and goes, you know, when left alone, John is noodling. When left alone, John is noodling. George has heard something interesting. Ringo is sitting by. You know, like that would be great. I mean, you know, it's definitely an anthropological, sociological event, Get Back. But yeah.
Yeah, and absolutely. And that would be just the funniest narration ever. Like really, just sitting listening to that. So are you a fan of early Beatles or later Beatles?
Well, this is one of those things where time has made me see it all holistically. But I would say that when I was a kid, when there was only early Beatles around, which is, it blows the minds of younger folk. But there was a time when John Lennon was alive, you know, and back when I remember being at a skating party in North Toronto, where I grew up in Willowdale, and they had a PA playing what was called the Twist and Shout album in Canada? Because now I've forgotten with all the American and British titles. The one where it's a pink cover and they're jumping up and down. This was She Loves You.
I believe so.
Yeah. And
yes.
They were playing that album, I think, on a vinyl record player hooked up to an outdoor PA system. And I was drinking hot chocolate and I just thought, this is heaven. This is like, for a Canadian Beatle fan, this was like to be out on a frozen over rink behind my elementary school. And hearing the Beatles while drinking hot chocolate on a cold winter day, it was like, what could be better? You know? So I love the rock and roll period, but I mean, with each success, I mean, I have fond memories of getting Revolver and being blown away by Tomorrow Never Knows and then pushing the envelope. And then my parents went to buy the single of Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane and looking at them with their beards on the cover, you know, mustaches on the cover and their cool threads and thinking, this is the Beatles, but they're just changed. They're like now they're really, and they kind of scared me almost. Like Strawberry Fields Forever scared me. It's a psychedelic song. It's
oh yeah.
You don't know from that stuff when you're a kid. And then you know the White Album was all over the map. But I loved how they could go from, you know, Revolution, the Dirty Revolution, to the Clean Revolution, and then like Honey Pie, and then Wild Honey Pie, and then. You know, and then Revolution Number 9 frightened me. And so there, I think Abbey Road became my favorite for many years, but Revolver kept, you know, coming back. It's like a horse race, really. I mean, the thing about the Beatles, there's an era of the Beatles for almost every mood.
Agreed.
Like, absolutely. You know, like the waiter comes to the table and says, are you in the mood for a little Abbey Road tonight, sir? You know, like, you know. No, I'm thinking, can you get us into some, to a, like, just a little Rubber Soul, please? You know, like, you know.
That's right. So that's actually a good segue to a later question. Do you think it was Revolver or Rubber Soul that showed their biggest change?
Well, everyone's got an opinion on this. The way I see it now, Rubber Soul, I mean, and someone's going to yell at me for getting it this way, but I see Rubber Soul as being the Beatles discover Dylan and folk singing and realize that they want to write songs that aren't conventional Brill Building boy meets girl songs. Revolver's where they refined it into the rock framework. So Rubber Soul's more, in my mind, a folk record. That's them reacting to Rubber Soul's them reacting to the folk boom and, you know, the cultural relevancy of something like Dylan. And then I think Revolver is them saying, but what was the Beatles version of that? And they made it more Beatley. They brought back, they're constantly getting back, if you will, to their rock and roll roots, and R&B had entered the frame. So then you got to Get You Into My Life. And, you know, there's so much that we never like consciously talked about how much black music inspired all their best moves, including Billy Preston. But I think that's how it went. So I think Revolver was the first, in my mind, Revolver was the first Neo Beatles record, and then Revolver paved the way for Sgt. Pepper, obviously. But I think think Rubber Soul was where they kind of went, oh, let's be serious. What would we be like if we were serious? And then Revolver was the refinement of that.
That's a fair assessment. So here's a tough one for you, and you may have touched on it. I know a song you've already mentioned is my answer to this, but I want to ask you, what track do you feel signaled the biggest change for them?
Oh, wow. I mean, can you even say that? I'd have to think. You know, for some bands, it's really easy, because I had this, we're talking about Talking Heads once, and realized that the song Ezimbra, Fear of Music, was so much more like Remain in Light that it was like, this was the turning point. But with the Beatles, I mean, could it be Tomorrow Never Knows? I mean,
what it is for me.
Yeah, because I feel like that's where everything that came after that is, you know, that's where they admitted that this is a studio only thing. But there's got to be another one. Yeah, probably. Yeah, definitely. If it's not that, then. Because Taxman still fits within the rock and roll framework. It's somewhere on Revolver is where it started to become, okay, now we're a brand new thing. And
yeah, no, I agree with you.
Yeah.
And I think you hit it right on the head there when you talked about that transition, that the Rubber Soul was, yeah, they want to be more serious. They want to be Dylan-like, especially John, who we know was a huge Dylan fan.
He couldn't hide his love away.
Yeah. And then I think they sort of, They picked up something from Dylan, and then they kept that in their pocket. But then when they did Revolver, it was still Beatles with this little bit more added to it.
Yeah, it was like, like I said, they were now looking out at the world, which, you know, along with like Derek Taylor press releases and George Martin's guidance, they could actually find a way to articulate something to the world that was reflecting the world. Whereas before, they might still have been somewhat in awe of the Shirelles, you know, they might have been ironically leaning more towards Phil Spector type songs at the beginning of their career, which is ironic because Phil Spector comes in on Let It Be, but only in post. But anyway, I'm getting nerdy. Well, that's why I'm here. I'm here to be nerdy. Whoever's listening, you popped onto a podcast knowing you'd get nerdy talk. So there you go.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So, like yourself, we're both sort of comedy aficionados. So I wanted to ask you, what was your first impression of the humor, and how important you think that humor was for them?
I personally think that's what, as a child, I responded to. Hard Day's Night was revelatory for me, just to see, also because my parents' sense of humor, my dad had records with Peter Sellers and Spike Milligan and The Goon Show and things like that. So that British humor, my dad would tune into CBC and hear some of those things played on the CBC radio. So for me to recognize in a song like Yellow Submarine, to hear, you know,
full speed ahead, sir,
you know, all those things, all those voices, and just even the way they're singing like a Salvation Army band was like kind of like a parody of you know, we all live with the, you know, and then some of the other things, just in A Hard Day's Night, though, especially, like, just, you know, I mean, there's some zingers, classic. We all know them. I mean, but, you know, I fought the war for your sort. And John says, bet you're sorry you won, you know. And he's very clean, you know, like. Not every pop group could pull that off. I mean, they were a boy band. Think about this. It's a little like if BTS made a movie where they're incredibly like Andy Samberg. Like, I can't even do the math. Because I feel like I become an old guy, but like, or if New Kids on the Block had made a movie where they were Will Ferrell, like, it's hard to imagine just how unique that was, that the Beatles had a sense of humor. So I'd say comedy had a large part of the myth, and I say it's a myth, it's a true myth, that the Beatles were always funny. Because as we see in Get Back, they're not always funny, but even when they're fighting, they're pretty funny.
Oh, you know, yeah, they were, yeah.
Yeah, because we all know humor is a coping mechanism, right?
Yeah. So do you think that humor helped them with the media, or was it a tool they just used to sort of get through those grueling press conferences over and over again?
Well, I think you just answered your own question. I think it helped them with the media because it helped them get through those grueling. And you can see it at times when And they have a clip of that in, I think I was just watching the Ron Howard film again, 8 days a week.
8 days a week.
There's one where someone says, which Beatle are you? And John goes, I'm Eric, or something like that. He says something, some name. Maybe I got the name wrong, but he says, I'm Eric. And he goes, so Eric, the Beatles are hitting North America. And he knows, and now John knows that the guy doesn't know. So he goes, I'm actually John. I was just kidding.
Yeah. And yes.
And he's like, ah, oh, sigh. You know, like, you know what I mean? Like, and there are other times when, even when John's apologizing for the Beatles are bigger than Jesus comment, he says, he starts joking as, you know, I'm just saying something, I've apologized and I'll keep apologizing. And it's like, you think is it bigger than Christ or Jesus or whatever he is or something like that. Yeah. And he can't even take the apology seriously. Cause it's like, you know, can I just say that there's one thing I never realized before is, how much Paul McCartney, I'll probably get some pushback on this. I don't think Paul McCartney lies. I don't think he's ever misrepresented anything. I actually think what he does is he leaves out details. But I think when he's asked about whether he used LSD, he told the media. He said, yeah, well, you're asking me. Yeah, I've taken LSD. He's not going to go, oh, no. You know, you know, yeah. I'm sure that there must be something he's not telling us. But he generally, you hear all the interviews, and even lately with Terry Gross, he was talking, and he answers so... so straight with everybody about everything and in Get Back, he doesn't hold back. He even acknowledges, oh, you know, John loves Yoko, you know, and, you know, when they're arguing, I don't know, like spoiler alert, but the flower pot scene where they're surreptitiously recorded in the cafeteria, they're both really straight about everything. And John, by the way, without the cameras around, when he doesn't think he's being filmed or be recorded, he's pretty straight about saying, yeah, I think we went too hard on George. Like, he wouldn't have said that on camera. He would have said, just razzing him, you know, lads, you got to be tough, you know, like, but when he's talking proudly, he goes, I think we hurt his feelings, you know, like,
yeah.
And I just think it's amazing that for all their humor, they're rarely lying. I always felt like the people that they were sarcastic to were kind of deserving it. Like they were trying to exploit them, you know?
Yeah. I think especially, and they were never overly mean. But there was some interviews
me.
He was very, very sarcastic. Like it just, there was, you know, you talked about the Beatles bigger than Jesus. There was one part of a press conference where he's so done. He's already apologized.
Yeah.
They keep asking about it. And he says, well, you know, tell me what you think about it, and I'll tell you if you're right. You know, like,
yes.
How did you see it? And, you know, so yeah, I think humor, especially later on, definitely became a huge mechanism for them. And they were very funny guys, the four of them together. And you see that now more so than ever in Get Back. It's like so incredibly funny, and they were surrounded by people that just seemed to be naturally funny too, which I think made a huge, huge difference.
Well, it must have been fun to have Mal go all the way with them. Like Mal from the clubs onwards to being there, you know, so, you know, and Mal is just, I mean, it's sad how Mal ended, but during that time under the Beatles employ, he was their roadie. He was their friend. He was their confessor. He was a note taker. He kept the yellow legal pad when Paul was trying to write songs. And, you know, he's the guy who remembered the names, and John would drop something and go, Mal, you know, like, you know, if John dropped a pick, Mal would get it for him. And it's like, and he was, and for all visual outward looks, he looks like he was happy to be just hanging out with his friends, like a big gentle giant that he was, you know? So
he was very faithful to them.
They protected themselves. Yeah. Even George Martin had a good sense of humor. There's moments in Get Back where George Martin should be frustrated that they're really blowing their time, but he kind of smiles and goes, let's get back to that one, shall we? You know, like
that's right.
And but he's laughing. He's they're all happy that they're still hanging out and being Beatles, even when it's tense as hell. And there's a lot of backstory.
No, absolutely.
There's a lot of backstory with John and Yoko that, you know, I mean, Yoko had a miscarriage and John discovered heroin, and like there was a lot of reasons why John was more or less emotionally checked out during Let It Be, you know?
Yep. Yeah, no. And we don't want to give away too many spoilers. I mean, cause there's so much we can talk about.
The car chase,
but
I was going to, we can't talk about the car chase, right? In Let It Be and Get Back.
No, don't tell them about it.
I just want to say that a lot of those scenes were actually Rémy Julien, who was the top living stunt driver at the time, and the and those cars were all on loan from Pirelli. That's all I'm going to say.
Fantastic. You couldn't even tell. So here's a really heavy question for you. We'll put it in the middle of them. What do you feel is one of, or what are some of the biggest contributions the Beatles made to the world other than their music?
Oh.
Or is it only their music?
Well, no, because I think in their naive way, and I say this with love, but in their naive way, they really did want to communicate. They wanted to use their spotlight to shine on other things. You know, John would mention at the time Biafra, which was his big way of, you know, general charity. He was more interested in, he became, and George too was also interested in saying, you know, maybe, you know, well, his interest in what we call Eastern religions or, you know, spiritual practices was also him saying, you know, don't look to pop stars as the thing to be, but here's what we've found. We're at the top of the hill and it's shallow up here. We're looking for something deeper. So I think in many ways, you know, and a lot of these things, you could say like Live Aid and all those things came out of the Beatles, and a lot of those things got abused. And certainly even the Concert for Bangladesh had a business nightmare attached to it. But the intention to use your pop stardom, you know, All You Need Is Love, the broadcast, you know, like they said, how about, you know, and there's a lot of hubris involved too. It's like, we're the biggest band in the world, so we're going to tell you that all you need is love. And maybe some people needed rent money, you know, like, but they knew that the thing they could offer that was more or less harmless and possibly inspirational was to say, you know, you should love each other more, you know, and their whole thing about apartheid, they didn't want to play in apartheid, and they didn't like racial segregation in the South. And
right.
They were kind of, I don't know, you know, I mean, I'm sure Dylan was doing, I don't know what Dylan was doing, to be honest, at that period. I don't want to get into that comparative thing, but, and maybe the Stones were secretly doing it, but I don't think any other rock and roll band was, especially a pop rock and roll band, I don't think they were using their position for influence that way. So that's something they gave to the world. And they also wrote the rule book on pop music, sort of, and some people hate this about them, but, you know, that you could be writing pop songs that had some melodic and chord and lyrical invention that went somewhere that didn't, you know, I mean, Pet Sounds came out of the Beatles, you know, right. You know, and the sense of, you know, Brian Wilson, of course, in turn inspired them, let's be fair, but, you know, they were listening to everything, synthesizing everything, and then they were using their soapbox to send it out again. And so Stockhausen makes an appearance on Revolution Number 9, technically, you know, in the sense that the sonic inventions of music concrete people were finding their way into Beatle records. So suddenly Beatles could say, here's something interesting.
Yeah. So
nothing,
you mentioned
you haven't heard before.
No, you know what? Here's the thing. I love hearing everyone's take on it because everyone is going to have a different feeling on it. And it's like you touched on earlier that everyone will have a different opinion. It's how you felt at the time when you heard something or what you think of it. So I love hearing it all. So you mentioned George Martin and Mal. And so here's a question I like to ask, and whether you wanted to weigh in on this debate, because it could be quite a heated one. Who would you say is the fifth Beatle? And is there more than one?
I actually think there's more than one. I think it's a little like I was saying about microclimates. In any given situation, someone's the fifth Beatle. And I would say that the fifth Beatle in the studio was George Martin, right? That's a pretty easy one. But the fifth Beatle in Let It Be was definitely Billy Preston. You yep. know, it certainly wasn't Michael Lindsay Hogg. But unless they had gone to Libya, in which case we'd give him full credit for that.
He tried. But, he tried.
Hey, boys, have you thought about going to Libya? Yeah, but anyway, but I mean, and then there's a period where I mean, Brian Epstein could have been considered a fifth Beatle, but I don't think he was really. Certainly, Yoko and you know, Yoko sort of became a fifth Beatle, but I mean, you could also say that Heather McCartney was a fifth Beatle at some point. But I think that for me, the safest fifth Beatles are George Martin and maybe situationally Billy Preston, you know? But I mean, there's probably 18 other Fifth Beatles that I'm not mentioning. Derek Taylor is a huge, I'm a huge fan of Derek Taylor, but he wasn't really, he was always writing about the Beatles. He was there, definitely helped them synthesize their own philosophy so that now we can say, like, the Beatles' love to me is as much a tribute to Derek Taylor taking the mythos of the Beatles and synthesizing it as to, you know, a utopian concept, you know. And I think that the Beatles were writing all these things as a kind of pastiche. And then, and Derek, being the publicist, said, how about we make it that you're always about love? You know, like, and they went, oh, I like that. Yeah. You can see Paul McCartney going, that's good, that, like that. So let's stick to my earlier answer. Say George Martin for the most part, and then Billy Preston for Get Back, because it's so clear. And Glyn Johns is not a Fifth Beatle. Glyn Johns is a great guy, but not a Fifth Beatle.
Yeah, he was really good. I didn't know much about Glyn Johns until Get Back and actually seeing him. And there's a part near the end where he's right on point with something. None of them are listening to him, but he's right on point about something. I'm not going to say what it is because I want people to see it. But you made a really good point there. Everyone's going to have a different opinion of who the Fifth Beatle is. And it could be at any given point in time who was most prevalent, you know, who helped most on this song or who helped most on that album. That would be considered sort of the Fifth Beatle. So
yeah.
I'm in agreement with you on that.
Well, yeah.
So being a writer, do you have any Beatle-related books? And is there any that you're a particular fan of?
Well, I have a lot of them. And there's some that I haven't opened.
I'll be honest.
I've got a stack of them. I can sort of see them from here. Like I got And in the End came to me last year, and I haven't opened it yet. I said this on Twitter actually just today, which was, sometimes I'm a little too close to my own takes on the Beatles to read other people's takes. But I will say that Revolution in the Head by Ian MacDonald was very good, and it really opened my mind to a lot of things. I liked the Hunter Davies book when it came out. I don't know how accurate it is now. Shout by Philip Norman had a lot of good details in it in terms of history. Jeff Emmerich's book, you got to take it with a grain of salt, but Jeff Emmerich's book, Here, There, and Everywhere, is, I think it's a really exciting breakdown of his work. Well, mostly his work with Paul McCartney, because the grain of salt is that he seems to have a very low opinion of George, and especially low opinion of Yoko. But you know, Jeff Emmerich, I think, did some of their best engineering, so worth reading. Sound Man by Glyn Johns actually touches on some of that, but it's about his broader career. It's not strictly a Beatles right. book. Actually, I really liked George's I Me Mine. But George's I Me Mine, which was written with Derek Taylor, and you know, and A Cellar Full of Noise by Brian Epstein was written by Derek Taylor also.
Right.
I love that. I actually love Derek Taylor's book, As Time Goes By. Sorry. Yeah. I'm actually looking at my shelf here to try and figure it out.
I was doing the same thing, leaning back, looking at my shelf at, you know, what if I had to pick some? And it's not an easy thing because there are so many Beatle books out there.
Yeah, Ray Coleman's book on Brian Epstein is good too. Epstein. I keep saying Brian Epstein.
I do it all the time myself.
Yeah. Yeah. That Ray Coleman. I mean, this, you know, and there's a great graphic novel about Brian Epstein called The Fifth Beatle.
Yes.
And it's this Vivek Tiwari. And I met him. This is the funniest thing. I met him at Book Expo before that book was widely. It had just been self-published, I think, or something like that. And he was at a booth at this trade show in New York. And I said, wait a minute, you're doing a comic book about the Beatles? And he goes, well, it's about Brian. I went, wow. And my mind was blown. And we exchanged business cards. And like, he's now like somebody I check in with once in a while. And he's, among other things, he's a Broadway producer who produced the Alanis Morissette musical Jagged Little Pill. But he wrote this graphic novel about Brian. And I think there's a movie coming out about Brian, which I just read about yesterday.
There is. I believe it's called Midas Man.
Yeah, which is, you know, very Hollywood type.
Which I think should be good. I mean, for me, I'm a bit touchy when it comes to Beatle-related things.
Yeah.
I wasn't a fan of Yesterday. Not to put it down or diminish what it was, but I'm just really picky about my Beatles stuff, and I will take it personal. I probably shouldn't, but there were some things in there I'm like, did you have to put that in there?
I just want to say my piece about Yesterday, which is, I think Yesterday started out with great intentions and a very clever opening salvo, which was, you know, what if you got credit for the Beatles and nobody else? What would the world be like without Beatles songs? And what would it be like, you know, and then you have to really suspend disbelief to imagine, hey, no pun intended, that these people would hear those Beatles songs and like them the way they like the Beatles, which I think is a huge disservice to the actual Beatles. And again, I don't want to give the guy a hard time, but where it got me, and I hope this isn't a spoiler alert for somebody, but the John Lennon sequence at the end, just like, yeah. No,
yeah,
just no.
That's exactly what it was for me. I'm like, you kind of lost me there. But like you said, it was a fantastic premise when I heard it. I'm like, oh, they could do so much with this.
Yeah, yeah.
And the actors, very talented.
Oh, yeah.
Was it enjoyable? I went and, you know, I kicked my feet around. It was you know, great to hear the tunes, but just not my bag.
What was that movie with Ian Hart? What was that movie with Ian Hart where he played John Lennon? Backbeat.
Backbeat. Yeah, I like Backbeat.
I like Backbeat too, and I thought that was really great to they really portrayed Ian Hart, I think it was, right, who played Lennon, and he really portrayed the anger and insecurity, especially him yelling at Sue Sutcliffe and just all of that. It was, to me, that was exciting. If you're going to do a biopic, you know, do that. You know, it's kind of like the Bohemian Rhapsody of Beatles, and then they did that thing where they used indie rock stars from the 90s to make music for the soundtrack so they wouldn't have to get the Beatles clearances. That was pretty cool.
Yeah. He was very good, and that was definitely ones that I liked. So sort of now, this is a question that sort of veers into your expertise, and everyone will have a different opinion on this. And I know there's been a debate on Twitter about it here and there. So how do you feel about the reissues? You know, Let It Be is the most recent one. You know, some say, you know, when these box sets come out and these releases, it's just the same old stuff in different packaging. What's your take on it?
Well, I mean, mea culpa. I had Giles Martin on the Record Store Day podcast recently, and that's my podcast. And
great podcast, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, that episode was especially close to my heart when I had Mike McCartney and the photographer Ethan A. Russell and Giles Martin separately in three interviews talking about it. But the thing about Giles is I think Giles does an incredible job of cleaning up the tracks and letting you hear things in a way that, like, he really warms up the kick drums. A lot of records that I love could stand to be given the sonic sheen and by that I don't mean adding something. I'm not a fan of something changing the sheen of something, but I guess I said sheen earlier. But what I mean is, I want to just be able to hear things a little clearer. Now, some people argue that the noise it wasn't a bug, it was a feature, you know? Like the noisy analog tape soaks up all the middle frequencies and creates a sonic glue, and you hear everything at once. Like, that's the argument for mono too, right? That hearing something in mono lets you hear it all through one speaker. But, you know, and certainly the early Beatles hard stereo versions were a drag, because if you were too far from one of the speakers, you wouldn't hear Paul or you wouldn't hear Ringo.
That's right.
Which was a fun game to play when I was a kid, by the way, you know, just like turn down the one channel completely and you'd have a whole new Beatles remix. But having said that, I think Giles is respectful of the intent as much as he can surmise it. And I really got a sense that his work specifically is about just letting it be, so to speak, letting it be something that exists in a way that is more up to date. You know, I personally love all of them. I've loved all of those things that have come out. I actually was hoping that someone would remix Ringo, the solo album, because I was listening to it the other day, and I don't know if it's just the pressing I had, but from Capitol Canada from the 70s, I guess. It just sounded so tinny, and yet you could tell that there's a lot of great work going on there. Richard Perry did that. He's a good producer. He's a great arranger. But I really wanted it to sound as warm as those Beatle reissues. And I thought, you know, I don't know, maybe it has been remastered. I actually don't even know, but I just noticed it the other day, 'cause I was listening to Ringo for the first time. It's such a great solo album with all the Beatles playing different moments in it. And yep. Somebody, you know, Photograph is one of the greatest. It's one of the greatest solo singles of the Beatles, but it's also, you know, it's George's song for Ringo to sing, you know, and it's just such a great big sound that ends up sounding tinny on this pressing that I have. So I would love people to clean that up. So that's my answer.
Yeah, I know. And I think you touched on it, and you made a valid point that it was, if the hardcore fans want to hear it without this, you know, cleaning and remastering, you still got the original records, right? And
yeah.
And no one's taking away from that. But you're right. With the remastered, it feels like they're sort of just peeling back these layers of sound and just cleaning them up and not adding anything. You're absolutely right on that. Not a fan of that. And we all know that the Beatles were not a fan of that with Mr. Spector, but we'll leave that to other people's opinions. But yeah, I just want to hear it as it was, but very clean. Like if there was a squeak on something, it's interesting. I want to hear that, right?
Yeah.
And it's not all, you know, flooded out with other sounds.
Yeah, in that respect, hearing a nice cleaned up version of Glyn Johns's mix is pretty cool, because that's the closest to the real Get Back you're going to get. A respectful just tightening up of Glyn Johns's mix, which was a kind of a warts and allish mix of Let It Be, and that's included on the box set, so that's pretty cool. Yeah. You know,
so and that's
want to say one thing. I just want to say one thing.
Yep.
Hearing, you can really hear the paper in the strings of the piano on For You Blue on the new issue. Whereas before you just wondered why the piano sounded a little dead. You might have recognized, if you're a musician, you might have recognized what they call a treated piano. But when you, without even seeing it in the movie, which you do see, I knew when I listened to it, I listened to the box set before I saw the series. And I recognized immediately that sound of vibrating paper inside the piano strings. And that, to me, is the kind of nerdy thing that you get from a nice remaster. That's all.
Yeah. No, I had no idea. When I saw them doing that, I'm like, what is going on? This is fantastic. And you're seeing right there what made the Beatles great. What made them innovative. Let's try something different.
And that was George's idea, wasn't it, Martin? I think.
It was George Martin.
When they let George Martin actually play on, like, be involved, because they were trying to keep him back because they didn't want to do overdubs. You know, they didn't want to, you know, they were wary of another. And then what did they go? They end up adding strings to everything, or not to I Me Mine and you know, and Let It Be, and you know, and it's just and Long and Winding Road famously. You know, that's the one that Paul still has a nervous tic about. But
we so. And this is a conversation that's come up on Twitter. I've seen it a few times in social media that people are now saying the Glyn Johns mix will now be considered the preeminent mix of the Let It Be. What's your opinion on that? Has that become a favorite mix for you?
It's funny. I just started saying something like that in terms of, I would say the difference is, I'm not saying it's the definitive mix. We now have a great version of what has been widely bootlegged before. In fact, it's a different mix than the one that was bootlegged. It's a different, there's various different aspects of it, but it's the Glyn Johns intention. And I would say that it's great in terms of sticking with the brief, the mission. The mission was, let's make a record that is, you know, a true Beatles raw record. I will say that I absolutely love the Giles Martin mix, and there's a warmth to Ringo, especially. I really feel Ringo. I'm on a huge Ringo kick anyway, but
I think a lot of people will be after Get Back.
Yeah, because, and the other thing is, you realize that Paul, of course, you know, comes off looking great in this whole thing, but Paul really connects with Ringo, and like, there's that, what I called online recently, I said Ringo has the good foot, in which bass players are always looking for the you know, the kick drum, because that's the thing that you can identifiably lock into. Usually it drives the song, and bass players have to pick that one note in the bar, you know, and it's usually the bass drum. And Ringo and Paul together, it's beautiful. I mean, that's the word for it. I wouldn't even say it's good or it's tasty. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. It's more than just a bass and a kick drum. It's two brothers playing together. And you know, all those things that we say when we talk about the Beatles.
So how much better or different do you think they would have been had they integrated George Harrison more in the songwriting?
Well, this is the, you know, the $1 million question. I mean, and it comes out in Get Back a lot. You know, at one, they basically, George was the kid brother, and George was always saying, "Hey guys, wait up." And John and Paul were kind of in love with each other's talent, and they had this bond between them being the Macklin team that they kind of, you know, ignored their kid brother, but they kind of, Paul, you could see it in the movie. Paul kind of has moments where he goes, "Oh, that's good, George. That's good." And John's still playing the game of, "Oh, is that another Harris song?" You know, he doesn't really want the competition. He's already fighting with Paul. He's already competing with Paul. And they're happy to compete if it makes great Beatles songs, but they didn't count on George. And so, but then George says, I want to do more than one song per album. At this rate, it'll take me 20 years. And so we know, with the benefit of hindsight, that he's going to make All Things Must Pass. But he says, I was thinking I could maybe do a Beatles record and maybe even have the Beatles play on it. And then do a George record, and then have the Beatles play on it. And then we'll do a Beatles record that's just Beatles stuff. And John's confounded by this idea. Like, wait a minute, you mean like a solo record? Like, what is that? And in 1969, in January, I don't know if they knew how to navigate this. And the example I've been giving to a lot of my friends is, you look at when Phil Collins did Face Value, okay? And it was a huge Phil Collins solo record. He was still doing Abacab, Duke, and he was still leading the pop genesis on MTV, as well as being the guy who sings, In the Air Tonight. And so there's a paradigm that nobody understood back then, that you could actually continue having a solo career. So I think that George... So, for instance, Abbey Road, after the row, after the fight, when they finally decided to take George back, and George goes, "Well, okay, then I'll give you some of my songs," because he was going to hoard them away. He was going to take While My Guitar, and he did take All Things Must Pass back. He said, "Okay, then we're not going to work on that if you guys would rather do one after 909. So then we have this Abbey Road, the next Beatles album, only a few months later, opens with Come Together. So John sings lead. Then Something, George is in the second position with one of the best songs he'd ever written, and certainly one of the best songs the Beatles ever did, maybe one of the best songs ever. So George sings the second lead vocal on side one. Then Maxwell Silverhammer's the third song, and then they decide, and then he sings Oh Darling, and then Octopus's Garden with Ringo all on one side, and then I Want You, She's So Heavy, which is a very full Beatles song. That's side one of Abbey Road. And they are at that point, I think, fully recognizing that this is how they should proceed. Unfortunately, it's a little too late. Like, I think, because they recorded that after Let It Be. And then right. I think at that point, it just got to be that they decided to maybe quit while they're ahead. We're going to hear lots of people second guess what happened. But they kind of realized that was the thing they needed to do to show that they could still do it. And then maybe they didn't know if they wanted to keep doing it. And by that point, I think also, you know, yeah, Paul wanted to do a solo record. George was going to do a solo record. John ends up doing solo records and hanging out with Yoko and doing John and Yoko records. And, you know, and then that's why it was such a big deal when Ringo put out the Ringo album after a few solo albums, that, you know, they gave him the Beatle love that he didn't get for a few years there. They said, "We're all going to show up for Ringo, and I'm going to give him I'm the Greatest," and Paul's going to give him that song about, was it 6 in the morning or whatever it is.
Right. No, I and everything you said is sort of is on par. And, you know, my opinion of it is that, you know, I don't think it wasn't for a hate of George. They all loved each other. I just think it was that insecurity of, I don't want the competition. And I wasn't so sure, or I didn't know as much about John's insecurities. I read Ken Womack's book recently about John Lennon in 1980, and it talks a lot in there about John's insecurities about him. Maybe I'm not good enough. I can't. So I think that, you know, George coming up with all this music, he's like, whoa, this is like freaking me out a little bit. You know, I mean, this is not what I need for my insecurities.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's purely speculative, but that's, you know, that's how I think about it.
Well, yeah, and there's been definitely a lot of sort of now that, you know, when you sort of examine the sort of the sort of patriarchy aspect of the way pop music used to be, and the way it probably still is for some people, but if you take a post-feminist sort of view of the way the Beatles were insecure men who didn't know how to handle their emotions and quite often clung to their mother figures, you know, Paul famously could not have got through McCartney without Linda, the McCartney solo album, and you know, John needed Yoko to fill that, you know, role in his life, you know, to help shepherd him as an artist and also to shield him from even from business. Like she was a very big part of that. I don't know about the other two so much in terms of that aspect, but you definitely get a sense that these were very insecure men at times. And Paul seemed a little more self-assured, but I love it in Get Back when John quotes back his own song, like he quotes back Help, you know, and it's literally a cry for help. I mean, he's literally saying, he's saying, you know, when I was younger, so much younger, I never needed any, feel so insecure. He's talking about the truth and he's saying, I wrote that song back then and I'm living it now. So, definitely. And that's, and then George leaving too was about his insecurity. Like he was like, why am I here? He's welling up. He's crying when they're playing Two of Us. He's blubbering almost. And he says, well, I'm leaving the band. I think I'll be leaving the band now. It's like, you know, one of the best parting lines ever, you know.
I'll see you around the clubs and that's it. That was one of the things about Get Back, and I'll touch on it quickly, and maybe you felt the same. I'm not ashamed to say I welled up quite a few times watching, now knowing what we know about the group dynamic at the time. Which if that, you know, if something like this had come out back then, people wouldn't have given this second thought. But, you know, now 50 years later, we know all these things that were happening at the time and what happened after. And so your eyes and your vision of it is much different than someone might have seen it at the time. And there are some parts it's very, very sad.
Yes, it's true. Once there was a way to get back home, you know, like that, right?
You know, absolutely.
And the long and winding road. I mean, by the way, I think the long and winding road, I realized watching him play it on piano, just one of the most amazing, it's a soul song from Mr. McCartney. I don't mean soul like R&B, but like it's a song it's a combination of his skill as a chord guy. Like the chords are going all over the place, but the melody goes up and down and everything supports this idea of somebody looking back. I mean, it really is an elegy for the Beatles in some ways, you know, and certainly the end becomes the actual song. The end becomes the literal footnote for the Beatles or postscript, but you know,
it's a very emotional song for me. It just seems to like just click on every point. And I think you're right there. So speaking of Paul, we'll come to some more happy memories for you. So I know you had a chance to meet Paul back in 2014, and there's a great photo that you put on Twitter.
Yeah.
How was that? Was that the only time you met him?
No, I actually met him. I've met him twice now. And the first time I'll never forget. And this, I think we talked about this off the air, that there are times when I will mention that my brother is Mike Myers, International Man of Mystery. And I was lucky in 93, I believe it was 93, Paul was doing the Off the Ground album, and he was going to appear on Saturday Night Live. And my brother was a cast member at that moment. So I was living in Toronto. So I flew a very cheap flight from Toronto Island Airport to New Jersey. And I took the bus in and I went to SNL that night to see Paul McCartney. I think the host was Alec Baldwin. And they did a few songs, but there was a party after the show. For one thing, I will tell you this. I got to sit on the floor of Studio 8H while Paul McCartney played, I think, Hey Jude for the first time on TV in years. And I was
amazing.
I was about seven, maybe five seats away from the grand piano. And I looked over and my brother had come out from backstage to stand beside me so we could watch it together. And we looked around and there's Sting and Trudy Styler like 2 feet behind him. And then John Bon Jovi. I mean, you don't get to choose who's there, but it was John Bon Jovi, Bill Murray. All these people had come back to see Paul McCartney on SNL. And so I'm there and we're watching Hey Jude, and Mike and I are just bawling our eyes. Everyone's bawling their eyes. And Lorne Michaels is crying. It's like, it's an amazing thing. And then At the party afterwards, Linda was there, of course, because Linda was still alive and playing in the band. There's a party afterwards, and we're sitting at a table, and you know, sort of one of those booths. And I look over, and so the SNL parties are kind of, you still have roped off tables, sort of. So you don't really go, you know. And Mike's, you know, a well-known person in the show at this point, so people are coming to the table. So I look over, and he's talking. McCartney's talking to Allen Ginsberg, which is kind of a trip also. And you're like, wow, one of the greatest beat poets of all time with one of the greatest musicians of all time. And then as they're leaving, Mike has worked with Paul all week. And my father had recently died about a year before that from Liverpool. So Mike had told Paul all about the funeral in Liverpool and everything like that. So Paul McCartney comes through with Linda, and they lean into the booth to say goodbye to Mike, to say goodnight to Mike. And he goes, oh, you should, I want you to meet my brother, Paul. This is my brother, Paul. And Paul leans into me and says, hey, sorry about your father. It's like, oh my God. Like Paul McCartney's first words to me are sorry about the loss of my own father. And I shook his hand, and it had like musician's calluses, you know, like from playing the bass and guitar, I guess. And he, and I said, oh my God, I'm shaking a Beatle hand and you have calluses. And he goes, yeah, comes with the territory. And I said, I hope I'm not like a zombie fan. This is a big moment for me. And he goes, no, I know the look. It's okay. And like, and I thought that was the coolest thing. What I was saying earlier about it, he doesn't really lie. He knows. He's the Pope of the Beatles. He's going to meet everybody. And they're always going to be like, this is a special moment for me, you know? And then Linda, this is the kicker. Linda leans into me, and she's such a nice lady. I don't, only met her this one time. And he goes, Hey, Lynn, this is Paul, Mike's brother. You remember, his father's from Liverpool, yeah? And then Linda leans in and goes, oh, hi. And she leans in to give me a kiss on the cheek. I didn't know which cheek she was going for and ended up kissing her on the mouth. I mean, it was a small lips. It was like a lips meeting lips kiss. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like a full-on romantic kiss. But right. I was so freaked out, man. It was like, but anyway, and then they left. So then that was it. I mean, that's all I needed. And just to have him know that my father was from Liverpool was kind of a big deal. And then, okay, so then the 2014 was Candlestick Park. You know, the Beatles, I believe it's the last North American appearance by the Beatles, Candlestick Park, or last, yep. At least the last time in San Francisco, as far as I know. And it was closing. So Candlestick Park was booked as the last date on of the season at Candlestick Park. And it was, I don't know if it was McCartney's last date on that tour, but it's the Out There tour. And by this point, I knew Brian Ray and a couple of the other guys from the band. Actually, as it turns out, I think I sort of know all the guys in the band now through Twitter. But I'm at the party before there's a kind of a reception. And I'm in this like tent sort of. And it's the tent where they put people who are going to meet them. And there's like Nancy Pelosi's there. And some of the guys, Bob Ezrin was there. Bonnie Raitt was there. The bass player from Green Day was there. Mickey Hart from the Grateful Dead was there. We're all lining up to meet Paul McCartney and to shake his hand. So Mike and I go up. Oh, I should point out that my brother flew in and got us the tickets. It was kind of a gesture on Mike's part. It was like, I have a chance to go to this show at Candlestick. You live in San Francisco. I'm going to fly to San Francisco and get you in. And like, we'll get in. And we had like fifth or sixth row in the show, but we had backstage access. So we're backstage and, you know, there's all these celebrities all lining up, and everybody, you know, defers to, like, no matter how famous they all are backstage, it's McCartney. So there's a line where he's got his makeup on for the show because his TV camera's involved and everything. He's wearing his clothes, and he's standing in front of a rug to have his, or like a Persian wall hanging, I should say, and it's to have the photograph taken, that everyone wants to have their photograph taken. So they control it, they take the picture, and they give you the photograph. And so we line up, and I said something about, I forget what I said, to be honest. And he said, it's like when we wrote, Hey Jude, you know, we would blah, blah, blah. And he's just saying something, and, you know, he's probably said it to a million people, but we're all hanging off every word. And, you know, and then he's saying to my brother, like, we'll see you again, you know, cause he's friends with my brother. I mean, I don't know. Mike doesn't call him up every day, but I mean, he probably would return a call, you know, which, and again, it blows my mind being this little Beatle kid who started out, you know, in the Willowdale suburbs of Toronto, you know, and just to know that Paul McCartney even knew that my dad was from Liverpool, you know, whether he remembers me or not, you know, like, just, it's kind of amazing. Those are my Beatles stories.
That was amazing. Thank you for sharing those two stories. So My next question would be, and maybe you've just answered that, did you ever get a chance to meet any other Beatles?
I had a chance. So I'm sort of friends with Todd Rundgren. I'd say I'm friends with Todd Rundgren because I wrote this book, A Wizard, A True Star, Todd Rundgren in the Studio, Plug Away, Paul. And he was playing in Ringo's All-Star Band. I think he still might do that from time to time, pre-lockdown, right. Maybe post-lockdown. He said he was playing San Francisco, and I said, oh, could I never would trouble you to do this, but can I come to the show and maybe meet Ringo? And he said, sure. Come to the show and we'll get you backstage and you can shake his hand. So as the show's coming up, my father-in-law on my wife's mother, father dies around the week before the show. And there's no question that I have to go back to Toronto for this. Like he's actually dying. So we had to get there in time. And so I just said, I'm going to have to not meet Ringo. So I let it go. And then I find out Ringo had a cold and canceled the last 5 dates of that tour. So he never showed up in San Francisco anyway on that tour. So the good news is I went with the right answer, which is go be with your father-in-law. And the even better news for me was I didn't actually miss meeting Ringo because he didn't show up. So, but that was exciting. And my brother, of course, famously had a transaction with George Harrison that he's talked about, which is George was a big fan of Austin Powers, which is like amazing to me. And George wrote, when he was dying, he was sending notes to people and he wanted to get a Dr. Evil doll. Because, you know, he'd heard about them and he really just wanted to let Mike know that he really loved Austin Powers. So he wrote, he dictated a memo, which was sent out on Dark Horse Stationery, I think. And it was, you know, Mike had said something in a documentary about he felt sad when the Beatles left in A Hard Day's Night with the, you know, the BEA helicopter that was just the Beatles, you know, the Beatles, and then the TLAS falls off and it's BEA, British Airways. And, right. And he said, Mike had said in this documentary, I'm sorry we left without saying goodbye. No, he said, we left and then they left without saying goodbye. And then George said, hey, I'm sorry about that time we left without saying goodbye. I really wanted one of those Dr. Evil dolls because I'm surrounded by frickin' idiots, right? And this letter was dictated like a day before George died. So it was, I believe, and you know, some Beatleologist will tell me I'm wrong, it's my understanding it was probably one of the last sort of memos that he sent out, which is kind of fantastic. So Mike has that framed, mounted, you know, with the mat around it. And it's a two-shot of the letter on one side and Dizo Hoffman's famous early photograph of George. And, you know, Mike named a dog George Harrison after that, too. He has one of his dogs was named George Harrison. And just like that is, to me, it's not my life, you know, I mean, I'm related to Mike, but I mean, the fact Mike had that happen in his life is just a miracle, right? And that Paul can talk to him every so often. I don't even know what he stands with Ringo, but I would love to meet Ringo now. I just watched his master class on drumming and it's so fantastic. Earlier, I'm a huge Ringo fan. So
I've heard about that and it's something I want to check out. And thanks for sharing that story about Mike with George. I only learned about that a few years ago and it was sort of like, it was a bit heartbreaking, but just very bittersweet. And I'm sure Mike was quite thrilled about that.
Yeah.
So which film is your favorite of the Beatles?
You know, I got to say that A Hard Day's Night is a brilliant 60s film. Help is fun. Help is beautifully shot. It's full color. It's a travelogue. They go everywhere. The Swiss Alps, Bahamas. But it's not as good as a movie. It's not bad. Magical Mystery Tour, probably the least entertaining film, but the most fascinating film. And again, anytime I say anything like this, somebody will say that Magical Mystery Tour is their favorite Beatles film. And, you know, Let It Be... Get Back by Peter Jackson is probably now, it's different though. It's a documentary in terms of like narrative film. I mean, A Hard Day's Night, hands down. I mean, it's black and white, but may they never colorize it because there's something absolutely perfect about it being black and white. And Richard Lester did a fantastic job on that. And he did Help, but it wasn't the same, you know?
Yeah, no, I 100% agree with you. So let's talk Get Back now. You've obviously seen it. Did you like it?
Yeah, I loved it. I don't know if you ever saw An American Family, a documentary, PBS from the 70s, about this family in America. And it was one of the first reality TV crews follow this family around as their gay son comes out in the 70s. And the father's not handling it very well. And the mother's divorcing the father. And we watch this very typical Midwest, or, you know, middle American family dissolve on camera. And it's anthropologically fascinating. Get Back, that and Some Kind of Monster by the Metallica documentary are the films that I think of when I think of Get Back, which is, it's grueling at times. It's really painful at times, but you really have to follow it through because it wouldn't make sense if it just showed the Beatles having a good time. You have to see that they had a bad time. You know, everybody had a hard year, you know, and it was, you know, but then here comes the sun at the end, you know, and not the spoiler. I mean, it's still a little sad at the end, you know, but it's not sad the same way the beginning is. The beginning's very sad. It's, but having said that, I mean, I couldn't look away. I couldn't look away. Every night I would watch when new episodes dropped at midnight, even though I knew I was probably not going to make it to stay up till if I had a long day, I wasn't going to be as attentive at 2 a.m. as I would have been. So I would watch it again the next evening, you know. So I watched every episode twice, once half asleep and once fully awake, you know. And so I had to watch it all. And then at the end of it, I was like, I put on Ron Howard's 8 Days a Week just as a chaser, you know. Because that's a comparable film in terms of dealing with what it was like inside the bubble. But I mean, it wasn't the same verite approach as Peter Jackson. God bless Peter Jackson. I mean, just an amazing, you know, they, you know, and in a weird way, it's like They Shall Not Grow Old, the film he did about World War I, you know, except instead of soldiers, it's Beatles, you know.
Yeah. And I've heard that comparison as well. And he did a fantastic job. I think he did a wonderful tribute. And I think he kept the integrity of what they were doing at the time. I mean, everyone's always going to have an opinion, on it. And I'm sure we've both seen lots of Twitter feedback about this. I can't remember the last time that there's been this much conversation about the Beatles. Is this Get Back? And everybody's got an opinion.
Yeah.
And as I said, I only just finished it this morning. And so I was trying to stay away from Twitter as much as possible because there was screenshots and this, and someone had picked out that. And I think you were right. This and the Metallica, film, you have to have everything. It's nice to have something clean and polished, but to give the true story, you have to have everything. You have to lay it all out in the ground. And they did not hide anything here. I was, as I mentioned earlier, it was very uncomfortable at times and very sad, but they put the happy times too. There's one scene, it's not so much of a spoiler, but it was in the third one this morning. I actually had to repeat it a couple times. I was laughing so hard when Ringo professes that he farted.
Yeah.
I farted.
Yeah. You're going to find out eventually.
Yeah. I was just going to sit here and stare at you, but I figured I'd tell you.
I think it was Paul who says, it hasn't reached me yet. It hasn't reached
me
yet.
Yeah, I think so. But Paul backs away, and the other two, George Martin and who's beside Ringo, doesn't even faze them.
No, it's true.
So what are some of your, if you can think of any, I'm sure there's tons, but what are some of your favorite takeaways from the film?
Well, certainly I love seeing Paul vindicated for... just, it's so beautiful to see how he does become domineering and takes on the mantle of the whipcracker of the band, but he doesn't want to be. What he really wants is for his buddy George to wake up, John to wake up. And of course, then he eventually I think he's also one of the first guys to recognize that George needs some attention. Because when George is writing I, Me, Mine, Paul stands there and says, this is quite good, you know, let's do this. And then when John shows up, you could see George suddenly becomes crestfallen. And he goes, I've written a song. Do you want to hear it? And John doesn't, is that a Harris song? So to me, those are the revelations, is that you see that they all speak of Mr. Epstein. They all speak of Mr. Epstein being gone, and they say Mr. And you know that it's the headmaster of their school has gone, and now they're not comfortable being creative children without somebody to tell them not to be. And they told George Martin that they didn't want him to be, but then, you know, slowly they couldn't stop asking him for stuff. But I think that to me is, you know, the best takeaway of it is to show that they didn't have all the answers, but, you know, even when they were fighting, they were searching to find the thing, you know, to get back home, as Paul would say. And I think that it's such a great, I've been in bands, I've been in other creative collaborations, and I've also been a brother. You know, I'm a brother, I have two brothers that I'm very close with, and we're all very creative. You know, people throw ideas at each other all day on texts. And I love that. I cherish that we can still do that. But there's that thing of the insecurities and all those things. That relationship of working out stuff on a collaboration, and it not always being easy, but sometimes it's worth it, is exactly the attitude you need to have to watch Get Back. I actually think that you don't even need to be a Beatle fan. And I would love to hear about somebody who, I don't want to hear from a Beatle hater necessarily, because that gets tiresome, but it's somebody who's not as up on Beatle stuff. It'd be great if they just saw it for what it is and told me what it was to them, because obviously we all bring so much to it. You know, the Beatles are a mirror, you know?
Yeah. So whether it's in this Get Back or if it's something else, what is your opinion of when the downfall started for them?
I guess the downfall was when they had reached the pinnacle of pop fame, but hadn't grown up yet and started having outside influences. Cause you know, the closed fist theory, like five fingers together make a fist, right? And you can break walls with fists, but once you break up the fingers, it's just, you know, fingers break pretty easily. So the idea is that, you know, when you have a common goal, a common enemy, the French Canadians and the post-English Canadians were united in defending Canada from the American army, you know, and then went back to fighting between each other, Quebec and Ontario, you know, like that whole thing. So the idea that when you have a common enemy or a common goal, even, you know, you're hungry, you're scrappy together. And something that, by the way, Lin-Manuel Miranda talks about in Hamilton is these sort of forces that decide to make the United States in an effort to break away from Britain, but then they start fractioning once they get settled in America. So I'm going somewhere with this, which is the Beatles, when they had a common goal of going to the toppermost of the poppermost, could be in each other's pockets all day long. But then when they had some fame, they had apartments, they had lives, they had girlfriends. Paul was, you know, with Jane Asher, then with Linda McCartney or Linda Eastman. And then, you know, and they were living far apart. And so they would be writing songs on their own or not writing songs. And in the case of John, you know, coming in, not quite having done his homework because he was living a life. And then they would talk about what they watched on TV, but they weren't really on the road together or anything. So that's probably where it started to break down, probably when they stopped touring, because they didn't have to be in the same, and touring wasn't ready for them. Touring, you know, I one of the joys of seeing the Paul McCartney band in the last few years, like the last decades, has been that they finally have PAs and lighting and monitors, and it you could hear what the Beatles would have sounded like had they had that equipment and could hear themselves, and then it was still enjoyable for them to play a show. But once they couldn't do a show anymore, they didn't have that common touring thing, which created some bonding, and they had, you know, necessarily outside influences. And, you know, it's going to happen in any group, probably any group of people. I mean, I don't hang out with the people I hung out in high school, you know, like, yep. You move away, you know, I mean, they didn't have Facebook back then, so they couldn't stay in touch, you know, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Kidding about Facebook, but you know, we all keep in touch with a lot of people now. But it's very hard to stay connected the way they were for as long as they did.
So, and this is purely speculative and opinion-based, one of these questions, which are always tough. We all know what the Beatles did after the Beatles, you know, in the early 70s and the mid-70s. How long do you think the Beatles might have gone on had they not broken up?
The two speculation roads are they would be the Rolling Stones, and they would do reunion tours where some years they're just playing old hits, some years they're doing a Get Back. What kept the Beatles special was that every album was special. Rolling Stones managed to make a lot of records that weren't as special. I get a lot of hate mail from Rolling Stones fans for saying that, but you know, the Beatles never sucked in the 70s, if you know what I mean. The Rolling Stones, by the way, were great in the 70s, and don't write me letters. But you know, so I always make the joke, and I'll make it again here, which is the Beatles never had to make an embarrassingly disco cloying to make social relevance album. They never had to make an album where they were, you know, doing light country versions of their own songs the way the Beach Boys did, you know, and so it's hard to say, you know, the Beatles lived fast, died young, and left a good looking corpse, as they would say. You know, there's an old quote about James Dean, you know, and so they were too fast to live and too young to die. So all of those cliches are true. So I don't know if, yeah, to me, the question is crazy, because I think what made the Beatles great is that they could only exist in a fireball, you know, and Paul McCartney's done a really good job of keeping the sound of the Beatles alive when he needs it to be. And in his live shows, and again, getting back to Brian Ray and Rusty Anderson and Abe Laboriel Jr. and Wicks, those guys do an incredible job of honoring the legacy. But Paul is the good steward of Beatleness, you know. And Ringo too, but Paul specifically, it's good that he's around to explain things. It's also good that we have Get Back to show the things that even Paul didn't remember, you know?
So I wanted to ask you about this, because this is something that's a hot debate on Twitter about the length of Get Back. There's been a few reviews by the critics. I've commented on one or two, but generally I generally just stay away from reviews, because it's really just opinion, how someone feels about something. So there's this talk, and I don't know how much truth there is to it, that there's this 18-hour extended cut that Peter Jackson's done.
Yeah.
But he's also come out and said, you know, I'm only the filmmaker and Apple owns the rights and the footage. And that's, you know, that's something you'll have to talk to them about.
Yeah.
Is that something you would be interested in? Would you watch a whole 18 hours of Get Back?
How can I say no? I mean, at this point, I mean, the only question is, would it be worthy of a Disney subscription? I would love it to be something that somebody slips to me. I would watch it on my own. I would watch it at home. I would watch it the same way you would watch, the same way people still find letters that maybe William Shakespeare wrote to Anne Hathaway, or you know, like, you know, it's too historical to not want to see it at least once. Now, I will tell you this, the 18-hour cut I do want to see, but I don't want to see the 60s, this a 50-hour one, because I'm absolutely right. Sure. I mean, if you've seen people's outtakes, sometimes it's because the camera was not filming the right thing. Sometimes the sound is horrible. Sometimes something is out of focus. And there's only so much nerding out I can do with completely inferior footage. But if he got it down to an 18-hour rough cut, as he says, I saw him on Colbert saying this, Peter Jackson says there was an 18-hour version, and then it came time to do the cuts, you know. But the 18 hours is he strained the tea leaves out of the water, and what's left is the clump of tea. So now he's made it into drinkable sachets. So I think, following my tea analogy, because I thought it was apropos of the Beatles, a little bit of toast in there would be great too. But so I think that an 18-hour cut of what he considers to be the things that were fished out of the water would be great. I don't want to see the 50. I mean, I say that if you offered me the 50, I'm going to watch the 50. Come on.
Agreed. But you're right. You're right. It's like they say, oh, there's, you know, 50 or 60 hours. And you're right. That's a lot of setup and the camera's angle that might have tilted back and staring at the ceiling. It's not, people have this misconception that it's 50 hours of just what they saw. And that's, you know, that's not the case. Paul, it was great having you today.
Oh man, this is so much fun. Wonderful. Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It was so much fun to get to talk like a nerd. And as it turns out, I think I actually remember a lot of why I like the Beatles. So that's great. So thanks for having me.
Thank you. So before we wrap up, I want to do my regular segment, just like you have on your podcast, and it's Get to Know the Beatle Fan. So it's four quick questions. So who's your favorite Beatle?
I hate this question, but I right now asking me on this is This is the end of November 2021. I'm going to say Paul McCartney, and I'll get a lot of hate mail for that. On any other given day, it'll be George or John or Ringo.
And what about your favorite album?
Again, this week, my favorite Beatle album is Abbey Road. I threw it on recently, and I realized maybe after Let It Be, I just decided that I needed to hear it, and it's unassailable. Other days, it might be Revolver.
And your favorite song?
Tough one, man. I think I'm going to pass.
Okay, that's fair. I would do the same thing. And what about your favorite Beatles look? It could be a fashion style, yeah, costume, or even time frame.
Post Pepper, probably just before Let It Be, when they're kind of in their turtlenecks and jackets, maybe not so much the mod stuff, even though it looks good on them. I think Paul in a turtleneck and John with his hair slightly side parted, but just a little longer, and he starts wearing the glasses. You know, Paul, I don't like Paul with mustache, but Paul with beard and full black hair is pretty cool. Ringo with mustache is great. George's best look for me is circa Revolver. You know, he started to look shaggy. And then, of course, I like him My Sweet Lord era for other reasons, probably to do with the early teachings of Jesus. But I'm not sure why I like George's look there. But anyway.
Those are all great answers. So finally, before we go, is there anything new you're working on that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I'm, of all things, my Kids in the Hall book, it led me to be asked by House of Anansi, the publishers of that, to write a book about John Candy, which is going to be a while coming, but I've been working on that slowly. And I recently got to interview like Catherine O'Hara, Steve Martin, Martin Short, Ron Howard, so many of the people who worked with John Candy, and so many of the people who worked, like, you don't know, that worked with John Candy as well. And it's going to be out over a year from now, but working on that. And of course, the Record Store Day podcast continues to be, so it's called the Record Store Day podcast with Paul Myers, and it's available wherever you get podcasts. And you can hear my interview with Ethan Russell, Giles Martin, and Mike McCartney. And we have a couple of new episodes up since then. So, and Elvis Costello has been on it, and it's kind of a passion project.
It is a great podcast, and I'm going to put the link to it and recommend it to my listeners. I've really enjoyed all the episodes. And I'm going to put a link to all of your books
so
that people can pick those up as well.
Thank you.
Paul, this has been so amazing. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having
me. And I wish you the best of success, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Great. Take care. Thanks for listening today. Thanks to my guest, Paul Myers. Now, you can look in the description to find links to Paul on his Twitter, his Record Store Day podcast, and links to all four of the books that I mentioned at the top of the podcast, The Kids in the Hall, Todd Rundgren, Long John Baldry, and The Bare Naked Ladies. I want to thank you all for listening. This episode brings an end to my first year, or season one, if you will, of the podcast. And I wanted to thank my first six guests very much for the chance to interview them. They all gladly accepted my invite. Me being a new startup podcast, I was really honored that they did that. I've loved every interview, and I'm grateful for the chance that they gave me. I wanted to thank you, the listener. I've been heard on every continent, and I've seen some of the names of the cities and towns where I've been heard, and it's absolutely amazing. I hope I've been able to bring some joy to people. It's why I do this podcast. I want to spread Beatles love as much as I can. I mostly want to thank the Beatles. John, Paul, George, and Ringo. I mean, really, without you, I wouldn't be doing this today. So thank you. I appreciate you all very much. You can reach me at abbeylanebeatlespodcast@gmail.com or on Twitter at abbeylanepodc if you have any questions or comments. Thanks for listening. Take care. Keep safe.